Welcome to Crosstalk, the recovery podcast for people who are looking out to figure out how to live sober, how to live happy. Happy is the most important thing, and find joy every day. That's what we're here for. We're hoping to bring a little bit of that to you through our interviews. I want you to like, press that bell, hit the crap out of that bell so that we know that you're looking at us, and follow us, subscribe, and let us know what you like and what you don't like so we can listen to you and bring you exactly what you want. Today, I'm very happy to bring a terrific interview to you, somebody who's been sober for quite a long time, a person who is going to enlighten us and inspire us. I feel certain, and I welcome Scott Barnes.
Thank you so much for having me.
Thanks for being here, Scott.
My pleasure.
So you're in New York City?
I am. It's Pride Weekend.
Pride Weekend, big weekend.
Big weekend. Pride looks a lot different 17 years sober than what it looked like in 10 years of active addiction.
What's the most significant difference?
No drugs. the camaraderie and sense of community is still ever present. So it's a must.
There's a movie called The Frisco Kid.
Okay.
And at the end of the movie, Gene Wilder is pointing a gun at the bad guy. He has an opportunity to shoot the guy that's really been driving him nuts. And I think one of the lines he says, it was a stupid question. He says it with an accent, it was a stupid question.
Right.
Or maybe that was from, I may be misplacing my movie lines.
Mixing your movies?
Yeah, I think it might be. That was,
okay.
That was the florist in Arthur, actually,
okay,
not Gene Wilder at all. He asked him, how does it feel to have all that money? And he says, feels pretty good.
Yeah.
And he says it was a stupid question. So the biggest difference between 2007 and 2024 is not using drugs or drinking or any of that stuff.
Exactly.
So what's that done, you know, to your life?
I mean, personally, professionally, spiritually, it's allowed me to grow. By trade, I am a special events professional, and during active addiction, I was in, you know, fashion lifestyle special events, which fed the actual, you know, alcohol and substance abuse.
Because of the environment you were in.
Because of the environment I was in. And, you know, fast forward, now I lead executive events for a Fortune 30 company. And, you know, that would never have been possible had I still been using. There's just no way.
What are the things that you're able to do? I realize showing up on time and being coherent when you're speaking, but what's the significant difference between, you know, why would you be able to do it now and not then, just because you weren't showing up?
Wasn't showing up on time, inconsistent in my performance, inconsistent in my communication, basically just having, you know, I started with alcohol, which then led to cocaine, which then led to, you know, every party drug, which then ultimately led to crystal meth. And, when you're on a run for crystal meth, you know, it's days and your serotonin's completely off. You could have episodes of psychosis, essentially to rebound from that would take time. So I just wasn't functioning. When I checked into treatment, I was 121 pounds pretty sick.
Right. So let's go back a little bit and talk a little bit about your early years growing up. Where do you come from and what kind of environment did you grow up in? And we'll kind of take us through a little bit of your story.
Absolutely.
And we'll go wherever we want to go. The great part about what we're doing is, unlike in a meeting where you can't interrupt the person, I'm going to interrupt you all the time.
Which is perfect. I like prompts because sometimes I lose train of thought. So
okay.
That's still part of my drug and alcohol abuse.
What were we talking about?
Right, exactly. So I grew up in a western suburb of Philadelphia, in a very loving household. Parents are still married, and were high school sweethearts, and had myself in 1979 and my sister in 1983. They still live in the house that we grew up in. And now fast forward, my sister and my brother-in-law and two nephews live four houses down from them. We had a really loving environment on both sides of the family. You know, my parents worked really hard to give my sister and I a life that they didn't have growing up. So both worked full time. You know, sent us to private Catholic school. And growing up family-wise was fantastic. Growing up in school was a challenge. I was definitely always different, a bit of a teacher's pet. I really took to girls versus boys in hanging out and the activities of girls, playing house, playing school, playing dolls, not, you know, being on a football field or what have you, which, you know, was the complete opposite of how my dad grew up. He is probably like all-American, you know, masculine, you know, played football, baseball, basketball, and a jock, essentially.
Were people in school typically bullying and all of that stuff?
Teasing. Bullying, I think, can be, A, overused, you know, and then, you know, I was never beat up in a bullying sense, in a physical sense. But I would be teased, you know, you talk funny, you walk funny, you're a girl, you know. Word sissy, queer, which is now more acceptable in the LGBT community, you know, as a connotation for our community at large. But back in the 90s was, you know, kind of a derogatory term. But name calling and teasing was more of what I had growing up. And I quickly figured out how to, and because my dad was very protective and still is of myself, my sister, and my mom and his family, and for the people that he, you know, believes in, whether that be his friends, whether that be a team that he's coached. And I quickly figured out that if I surrounded myself by men that would protect me, you know, I could survive, you know. So I became friends with all the football players and in high school. And, you know, I had a lot of pretty girls around me, which was right up their alley. And, you know, at the same token, you know,
they wouldn't let anybody
they wouldn't let anyone screw with me, you know. So
that's pretty smart.
Yeah, well, you know, manipulative. You know, once you're, you know, you're kind of born. You're born an addict, certainly, and you know, you're born with the, you know, strategic thinking that I use on a day to day basis now in my professional life. Yeah, so it worked out. So, you know, very kind of cliche high school, like friends with a lot of the football players, you know, hung out with a lot of the cheerleaders. That made a match made in heaven for, you know, blossoming romances in high school. I was the mascot. So sort of played both fields, no pun intended. And I survived. But along with that came a lot of beer drinking. I was always much more slight in build than the football players, but I would try to keep up. And so I drank, you know, from the beginning, alcoholically. Because
what age did you start?
I probably started drinking at 14, started smoking cigarettes at 13, and I was a blackout drinker, beer drinker, all through high school. Sloppy, life of the party, you know, a fun time. But
I assume you were valedictorian.
Not valedictorian, but for 3 years was president of my class in high school, and for our senior year could not become the president of the class because I showed up to the junior prom under the influence.
Interesting. Yeah. That's quite an accomplishment for somebody that started out feeling and being kind of ostracized or separated. You really rose to, notwithstanding the last year of high school, it's pretty amazing for anybody to be able to be the leader of all these people and not being exactly like everybody else.
Right. You know, and, you know, I went to Catholic school, and I certainly, you know, was always told growing up never to talk religion and politics. But, you know, gay in Catholicism, you know, has come a long way with our recent pope. But at the time, you know, was wrong and was told that, you know, you would die of AIDS.
It's still wrong in a lot of corners,
you know,
but it's
right. Better. You know, that you needed to marry a woman. I kind of in high school hid my sexuality, not kind of, I did. Mm-hmm. And always had the prettiest prom date and, you know, made a lot of guys jealous in that regard. But you know, sexually there was nothing right. going on, you know, and then I went off to college.
Drinking and drugging changed in college?
Drinking and drugging changed immensely in college because when I went to college, it was the first time that I was away from home. And I went to school for hotel restaurant management. I have a degree in hospitality management. And I was like off to the races because I had no supervision. So I was like a garbage disposal when it came to drugs. If, you know, someone was if the frat house was doing cocaine, then, you know, I was doing cocaine, and ecstasy came on the market and with the ravers, and I was doing ecstasy. And then after school, I, you know, after classes would sit around and smoke pot with, you know, in the dorm.
How'd you get a degree?
Barely. Barely. You know, I graduated with a 3.0 still, but I probably if I actually applied myself and showed up, you know, on a consistent basis, I probably would have excelled much further.
Yeah, I think the comparison between your job situation before and now
right.
is the same analogy. That's what it does. It makes us so we're not there.
It really is. And then I kind of took the same strategy. I went to school only 20 minutes from my parents' house, but I lived on campus, like where I grew up. And it was in a not so desirable neighborhood. So to, let me think about, to make the most of the social environment, you really had to join a fraternity or a sorority, just because you couldn't venture off campus.
Without being connected to that.
Without, you know, literally putting yourself in danger.
There was a protective...
and that's for anyone, gay, straight, addict, non-addict. Like, it was a highly ridden crime area. So... I then sort of used the same strategy and that I did in high school and pledged, you know, a fraternity that had a great sister sorority of the prettiest girls and, you know, worked my way through that system.
So it was a redux of high school with increased frequency
of alcohol and drug use,
right.
Definitely. And I'm not blaming that on my fraternity because, in fact, there was often times that they would say, like, what did you do last night? Or, you know, behavior that wasn't necessarily always, not the best, but that was always taken a little too far, you know, like blacked out or, you know, throwing up everywhere or getting verbal, you know, with someone because I always had them to back me up physically. And essentially, by the time I was a junior in college, I found downtown Philadelphia, and ventured into the gay scene. So probably around the age of like 19, I had a fake ID. You know, I was thinner, blonder, you know, and a little kid in a candy store when I discovered gay nightlife. And really, it was then that it was off to the races.
So 19 and off to the races, for anybody who doesn't know what the analogy is, you're talking about accelerating drugs and alcohol.
Accelerating use. Drugs and alcohol. You know, cocaine very regularly. Party drugs, as the terminology would be used. So your ecstasies, your ketamines, your GHBs. You know, I would start the party in Philadelphia, but then end the party in New York City 2 days later. Or, you know.
I imagine with GHBs, your GPA suffered.
My GPA did suffer with my GHB. Very, very much so, as did, you know, some wardrobe from falling out on it and getting sick and falling, you know, and you know, cuts, bruises, abrasions, things of that sort.
So you're right into the social scene, the gay scene in Philly.
Right into the social scene in Philly and in New York, both of them. And was not what they would call in the 90s a club kid to the extreme. But pretty darn close, you know. Definitely, you know, platform shoes, glitter, you know, Twinkie-esque, you know, persona. You know, never really ever waited in line in a nightclub. Always knew the bartender. Always knew, you know, the doorman. Or
and at this point, you're disconnected from the fraternity. You turn left.
Totally disconnected. So that, I mean, I like abandoned them. Not abandoned them in the there's still many of them that I'm friendly with to this day. Not abandoned them as the person, but in what they were doing. So like the days of beer pong were over, and the night. Of, you know,
sex, drugs, and rock and roll,
yeah. And life in the fast lane had begun.
So now you're a junior in college. You've made an about face, so to speak, in terms of what your choices are. How did I know you're today? By the way, is Scott's 45th birthday, so I'm honored that he's here doing Crosstalk on his birthday. And I know because. I know you went to treatment in 2007.
Yes.
And I'm very good at math. So I know that you got sober when you were around 28.
27, yeah.
27.
Yeah.
So we have some wood to chop here. You're 19. What does that look like in this period before you start seeing, a need to change your behavior?
Oh, well, it progressively got worse. You know, I graduated college. How, I'm not so certain, but I did. I think the biggest threat, for lack of better words, was my parents said, we will pay for 4 years of college. So if you're going to screw around and become a five-year plan or a six-year plan or be failing classes, we're not paying for it. And quite frankly, I would have rather used my personal money on drugs and alcohol. So, you know, I had that kind of hanging over my head.
That was good.
So that probably is what, you know, forced me to actually graduate from college. But then, like I said, I graduated with a hotel restaurant degree, and, you know, quickly became not only a life of the party, but a party planner. You know, it was acceptable to, you know, jump on a train to New York City and do some cocaine with models after New York Fashion Week, or, sample the latest cocktails in the hottest new restaurant in Philadelphia and indulge because that's what.
And you're 21 at this point?
21, 22, 23, you know, and you know, always had a very outgoing personality. That was something that I've had since I've been, you know.
Shocking.
Right, exactly. So, you know, quickly made connections, good and bad, I'm sure, yeah. You know. But like I said, you know, could get into this party and knew this person here and, you know, knew that person there and, you know, kiss babies and shook hands with the right people. And
you were successful in your
and early I was successful in that, but it was lifestyle PR and like fashion events, you know. So, you know, it was tolerated to behave the way that I behaved, mm-hmm. you know. Not only from a substance abuse standpoint, but also in a lashing out or being a diva or, you know, not speaking to people appropriately.
In both work and otherwise.
Yeah, absolutely. And, you know, that just progressively got worse. And through that time, my 20s, you know, I had two DUIs, two driving under the influences. The second one ended me in jail for 2 weeks.
Wow, what was that like?
That was rough. But again, I navigated the system and used a connection and was able to get put in the work release section of the jail, which is like best behavior versus general population, because I, you know, it was like they're going to hurt me in here and kind of pulled that whole card. But again, like that whole manipulative strategy.
2 weeks.
Yeah.
That's like forever.
That was like forever. I slept a lot. Probably A, because I needed it. But, you know, it was in jail the second time that really put the... So, and not to go chronologically too far out of order, but that was 2006, and I was doing a cryptogram in jail, which I hated. I was always like a crossword puzzle or word searcher. When I would do sorts of like puzzles growing up, I hated the cryptogram, like identifying the letter that really stands for another letter to make the words mm-hmm. that it would be. And I was in jail, so I had nothing better to do. So I was doing a cryptogram. And what came up in the cryptogram was, the problem with life in the fast lane is it comes to an end in an awful hurry. And that was sort of like the wake up call. Like, you got to start.
It's like an aha moment.
Yeah. You got to start like doing something.
What was things like with your family at this
point? Oh, my God. Well, they supported me the whole time.
You're in jail, and they're getting you lawyers, and they're...
Lawyers, paying legal fees. You know, my dad was a banker by trade for 40-plus years, and, you know, all of my bank accounts were with his bank. So, you know, oftentimes there would be a teller that would come to him and say, you know, hey, Tom... Scott bounced a student loan, or, you know.
So I get the sense that your parents are amazing people.
Amazing people.
And that you have a great relationship with them.
I do.
But, you know, when we do this, a lot of people say they want to hear more about the family side of things. Mm-hmm. And they want to hear about the impact of spouses, children, parents. And with college, they were able to draw the line 4 years.
Right.
And I suspect that it was really hard for them to draw the line when your freedom was at stake or your...
Well, they didn't draw the line. They, in fact, enabled. And I say that with all...
That was the point I was going to.
Yeah. They really didn't draw the line with me until I got into treatment.
It's such a hard thing for them to draw the line, because they love you and they want you to be okay.
Exactly.
And it's so hard to make that judgment as a parent.
So when I would bounce, you know, over withdraw my account because I was putting it up my nose, you know, my dad was putting the money in to, you know, pay the bill or whatever, you know, that I bounced.
The reason I bring it up is because, as hard as it is for us when we're sitting in jail for 2 weeks and can't figure out a way to live a different way, they're going nuts too.
They're going nuts. You know, there's a certain song, and we joke with my dear best friend that I'm here with this weekend, who's also sober, but was big in New York nightlife, especially in the gay scene. She always sends me a song that was like our getting ready song when we were going out. And the joke now, you know, multiple years later, is my mom would say when she would hear that song, she knew she wasn't going to see me for days because it was like giddy up. Wow. Yeah.
Talk about powerlessness.
Yeah. Yeah. Yeah.
That's a kind of defines it for the
Darude. Sandstorm by Darude is what it's called. Yeah. But so I, you know, served my jail time, and part of the jail, I still wasn't completely done, but I knew things were really coming to a screeching halt, not only from that aha moment with the cryptogram, but also part of my sentencing was to be on house arrest for 75 days after my, so the state of Pennsylvania, your second DUI is 90 days of confinement for a second DUI. However, if you're compliant with everything, they'll allow you to do 15 of those days in jail and 75 of them on house arrest. Well, on day 45, I violated house arrest and was off to the races.
And your violation of house arrest, I'm going to guess, had something to do with drugs.
Huge. Two-day bender, ankle bracelet and all. Running through the street, you know, not literally running through the streets, but, you know, bebopping through the streets of Philadelphia. Basically, my parole officer said, you know, you're going away. Like, you're going away. And I pleaded and said, if I can get help, will you let me get help? And for some reason, you know, and by another connection that I had in the county, my probation officer was not thrilled that I was like pulling these connections out. You know,
yeah, it goes over his head and yeah, emasculates, you know, his power.
And was able to go into treatment, which led me to where I went for rehab, which is the Karen Foundation. And the reason I went to Karen was because I had been in and out of a few other treatment facilities, most notably mental health facilities from my extended drug use. I was 302'd. And for those that don't know what that is when you are committed by someone else to an institution. And I was 302'd two times by my family, once from a suicide attempt, and the second because of my, you know, extended drug use.
So you're 27 at this point.
That was that was 24 and 26. Jail was 27. February of 27, violation of house arrest was in March. My last run was March 28th, 29th of 2007. So my sobriety date was March 30th because Karen couldn't get me a bed until April 5th. But I was not allowed to leave the state of Pennsylvania. So I had to go to Karen, and I pleaded with my parents to put me into Karen. Not only because it was in Pennsylvania and my probation officer, you know, said I couldn't leave the state, but because I, from the institutions I have been in and out, I was teased a lot also in like the state-run institutions. So I begged and begged and begged and was like, I will get help, but I need to be like in a private, like-minded, safe place.
And you and I both are big fans of the Karen Treatment Center and the Karen Foundation.
Yes.
I know from our talk before we started that Karen's scholarship helped you get there. Might as well give a plug for the...
Absolutely, absolutely. So, Karen at the time, fortunately or unfortunately, addiction is more prevalent now, but fortunately, the healthcare companies are subsidizing, the cost of treatment at a lot of the premier facilities throughout the nation now, which is fantastic because it's making addiction treatment more accessible for all.
And as I understand it, it's not because they're so generous of spirit. It's because when you go to a good place, you're more likely to stay sober and cost them less money.
That's correct. However, when I went 17 years ago, Karen was completely out of pocket. And it came with a hefty price tag.
Meaning no coverage.
No coverage. So my parents took a mortgage out on their house that was already paid off and paid in cash with a scholarship assistance. Fortunately, the Karen Scholarship Program looks at the individual goings finances, not the individual paying, because if that was the case, they probably would have,
right,
not given me a scholarship. But essentially, I was scholarshiped, and my parents paid a big chunk, by taking a mortgage out on their house.
So between Karen and your family, they gave you an opportunity.
They gave me an opportunity. And my probation officer, because she was not thrilled that I went over her head and went to the sheriff of the county.
So what'd you do with that opportunity?
Well, I think in hindsight, I seized the opportunity because, again, just like the quote-unquote hanging over the head of 4 years being paid for college, I kind of still had that, Catholic guilt in the back of my head that pushed me along to, not pick up. Relapse was not part of my story, fortunately, but the road to get to recovery was oftentimes, mental institutions, a meeting here or there, violation of a house arrest,
DUIs, jail,
etc.
I mean, I think you probably qualify for this program.
Oh yeah, absolutely. Yeah. I mean, the reality is when you read our materials in a 12-step program, they say jails, institutions, or death, and the third one you're not coming back from, and that just wasn't what I wanted. So I already did check the box on the jails, and I already checked the box on the institutions. Fortunately, didn't check the box on the death.
Thank goodness.
Yeah, exactly. But basically, the first 2 months of my time in treatment, I was brutal.
What does that mean?
I was not compliant. I thought my way was better than, a nationally recognized...
Clinically, I think they call that being an asshole.
Oh, yeah. Clinically an asshole, yeah. Figuratively an asshole, literally an asshole, all of the above. And there was two men, actually, at Karen that really put out their hand to me. And one was a spiritual advisor by the name of Father Bill. And he would come into my room every morning for those 2 months and say, are you going to, come out and join us today? And I'd say, get out. You're nothing. You're just a stereotypical Catholic priest. You're up to no good, blah, 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 blah. Always had, a comment for everything.
You found out he wasn't.
Yeah. Big time nod. And he connected me to a gentleman by the name of Tom McDermott, who is still at Karen, and said, "You are a lot to handle," but Tom was a lot to handle, and before he got sober. So I think even though Tom ran our young adolescent program at the time, and I was in men's extended care by that point, I think you need to meet with Tom weekly.
Tom's a rock star.
So that's what I did. And between the both of them, somehow, some way, going into my third month, it clicked. But I also had this great counselor, Donnie Shope, who I absolutely hated at Karen. I hated everything about him. He reminded me of the man that used to tease me He, you know, was a little rough around the edges, and he gave a lot of tough love that I didn't want to hear at the time. And, you know, I thought once again, you know, I would have a better, you know, outlook or advice on a nationally recognized, you know, program. But they didn't move me to another counselor, and that probably saved my life. You know,
yeah, pretty much when I think when you go into treatment, whatever it is we think would be better is usually the opposite.
Exactly. Exactly. So fast forward to August of 2005, I got out of Karen.
2007.
I'm sorry. August 5th, 2007, right. I got out of Karen.
I'm just trying to keep you honest.
I'm glad you did. And my whole first year, I had an extended care program where I had a recovery care manager through Karen that I met with weekly that got me into, a psychiatrist, an addiction psychiatrist, and a psychologist, and set me up with meetings, and, you know.
Did you get a sponsor?
I got a sponsor, all of the things. And my parents were gracious enough to pay for that as an additional contribution and allow me back in their home to live that first year. And I did not go back to planning events. A longtime friend that I grew up with owned a flower shop in the suburbs, and she had me work at the flower shop because the flowers didn't talk back to you and they didn't offer you drugs. And, you know.
Well, when you're sober, my experience is when you're sober, there's less likelihood of the flowers talking back to
right.
you.
Right. Exactly. Well, this is true. When you're under the influence, the flowers were definitely talking back to you. But basically, it was a mindless job that I was around someone that deeply cared about me that I grew up with. And it gave me enough money. She paid me, you know, in cash, enough money that would allow me to go to fellowship after meetings or give my seventh tradition to the basket. And
good reason to get up in the morning.
Have a purpose. Because I wasn't ready to go back into the world of events, or to the city for that matter, with people's places and things.
So you bought in, you had a good experience, at least the second half of your 4 months,
yeah.
Karen. You started doing all the things that they tell us to do.
I did, and I became very active. I became a member of the National Alumni Leadership Council, and was, you know, speaking everywhere and attending a lot of meetings. Got a great sponsor who, you know, is still, we're not as connected as we used to be, but still text each other for our anniversaries and our birthdays and things of that sort, you know, and on holidays and, you know, milestones. But then I got my second sponsor, who's still my sponsor today. And I have two sponsees. I have a home group, which was my first gay meeting that I went into in Philadelphia when I got out of Karen, the Monday night meeting of 22nd and Spruce, which has been around for, you know, I'm going to get the date wrong, but I want to say we just celebrated 52 years of our home group. So there are, you know, the first half of the meeting is for the beginner. And the second half of the meeting is open to all. So you really get what it's like, what it, you know.
A little bit of both.
A little bit of both, you know, from a perspective standpoint. And then I gradually came back into the city. You know, dear mentor of mine.
City,
Philadelphia. Yeah, I'm sorry. I know, you New Yorkers, if I say the city, you know, it's only New York. But that's okay. That's okay. but a dear mentor of mine and friend to this day owned a PR agency and had a family member that was in recovery, so was very familiar with needing to make meetings and the importance of that, and offered me a job back in my field, but protected me from the vice of it.
It's a great situation.
Which was a great situation. And kind of gave me my break, you know, my break back. And I'm still very close with her to this day. That then led me to a position for a restaurant group that was based in both cities, Philadelphia and New York. So I, you know, was able to scratch the itch of my New York City life again, and this time professionally versus, you know.
And sober.
And sober versus, you know, after parties that I would come up the turnpike on, you know, at insane hours of the morning. And that then led me to my current position, where I was on the radar of some of the executives that then brought me in to lead what I lead now.
So, you know, it occurred to me when you talk about that was my break, I can think of a good deal of breaks along the way.
Yeah, there's a lot of breaks along the way.
But now, sober, 17 or so years later, you're giving other people breaks.
I'm trying to, you know, with my work schedule, my schedule's a little inconsistent because I'm still in events, but I'm in corporate events, but I'm not a Monday through Friday 9-to-5 position. So, oftentimes I can't take like a monthly commitment to chair a meeting or, you know, a service commitment to speak somewhere, because my schedule fluctuates. So what I have found is it's important for me to have my sponsees in my life, but also to try to be of service elsewhere. And I re-engaged with Karen and was, you know, appointed to their regional advisory board for Philadelphia, and then most recently named to their treatment committee. Which is a great honor. I never would think, you know, 17 years later, I'd be, you know, consulting on the treatment of others.
I know you feel good about that. I'm curious, with your relationship with your sister,
yeah,
her family and your parents, how's that changed over the years?
Well, it's changed immensely. And again, not to make this a Karen podcast by any stretch of the imagination, but during the family education program, and this is something that I didn't touch on, they do an exercise at Karen of when you feel, or when you blank, I feel blank. And I turned to my dad and I said, when you drink, I feel angry. Because he drank a lot when we were growing up and alcoholically, but was a functioning alcoholic. And right then that day, May 17th, 2007, while I was inpatient, my dad stopped drinking.
Wow.
And has not drank since then. And that, you know,
that's kind of stunning.
Stunning.
For somebody who, you know, all his life probably.
Yeah, all his life. Yeah. He did not. He did not. He did not go through recovery.
Quite a statement of how he loves you.
Yeah, exactly. A huge statement of how he loves me. And I think it helped, you know, his marriage with my mom and helped his relationship with my sister and I. You know, but really tight, you know, my journey, you know, I wouldn't be here if it wasn't for without my mom, dad, and sister, because they really never turned their back on me. But I know at the beginning of our conversation, we had touched on, like, when did they draw the line? Well, when they drew the line was when Karen said, you are not leaving here after 30 days. You are going into extended care. I wasn't having that. That was not part of the plan. And my parents said, well, then you're not welcome back. Like, it's part of the plan. Like, we're going to figure it out financially, But
yeah, it's
there's no option.
It's really interesting how both sides, you know, I we've heard the phrase, the family's the patient's the family.
Absolutely.
And if everybody is not involved with this change, this process, it doesn't really work. It can work, but it's very hard. But when you get when you get the significant other, or whoever it might be, to do something like that, I can't imagine how uncomfortable they were, you know, laying down the law.
And they did.
And they did it.
It was rough. I actually remember vividly looking over, because they've said that 100 times before, you know what I mean? So, like, it was like kind of crying wolf, you know? And I looked over at my sister, and she was crying, and she said, they mean it. Like, and that's all she had to say. Like, she's, like, it, just the way she said it during that session.
You knew this wasn't bullshit.
This wasn't bullshit. Yeah. Yeah.
Well, you're a lucky guy to have been born to your family.
Absolutely.
And to have that kind of support. And you're also really good at, you know, getting people to help you.
I am.
You know, from the early days in high school to college with the frat,
mm-hmm.
you know, to, you know, it seems like you're a really good connector.
Resourceful, people. I like to call
yeah,
it.
Yeah, I like that. I like that. And now you use those same skills for good things.
I do. For good things. In my professional job, I need to be resourceful. And giving back, you know. It's not to say that I won't take, like, a coffee commitment, because, I have no at one time I had a big problem with that. I'm not making coffee. I throw parties for people. You know, right. The caterer makes coffee. Like, I'm not making coffee for someone. But I have no problem doing that. But I feel like I can give so much more than just a coffee commitment, or chairing a meeting. And fortunately, Karen Yedela, you know, like I had mentioned, had me back, and we started me back on a gala committee, which then led to me being on the advisory board, which then led to me being just recently appointed to the treatment committee. And then I give back to two other boards in Philadelphia, LGBT Youth Center, and a organization that feeds, it originally started feeding people with HIV AIDS, but now it's any terminal disease. And I'm able to use my professional talents and connections to help others.
I can't wait to see what the future looks like. It's going to be a long, very productive, and you know, a future that's going to have you go to heights that are really unlimited, because what you've done in the period of time of your life that we took a snapshot today, really remarkable to think of where you started and where you are right now, both professionally and personally, and you know, really it's remarkable.
Totally. And I think I'd be remiss to say, like, the two greatest joys of my life are my nephews, and they're 11 and 7. And they don't know me as an addict. They just think, like, Scott doesn't drink beer. You know, they don't really know.
He doesn't do crystal meth.
Crystal meth. You know, or used to do crystal meth, or, you know. But had I not gotten sober, I wouldn't be present the way I am in their life.
You might not know them.
Yeah.
It's a really...
I might not be here to even know them. So.
Okay, amazing journey you've taken us. Towards the end of an interview, what we try to do is, like, throw out some interesting questions.
Okay.
So I want to ask you, you're 45 today.
Yes.
And if you had the opportunity to speak to young Scott at some age, pick it, 10, 12, 14, what advice would you give young Scott if you were able to do that now, based on what you've learned over the years?
Probably the advice that I follow but didn't know I was following at the time, and that would be to, like, stay strong and persevere and get through, you know, and figure out a way. I don't think I knew that at the time that I was being resourceful, you know, or strategic or whatever you want to call it. But, you know, I look at, you know, my nephews now and, you know, youth for the one organization that I sit on the board for. And, you know, the message that I give them is to, you know, be true to themselves and stick through it, you know. So that would be the advice I'd give to me.
And the ways that we're really talking about resilience, I think, and being able to bounce, you know, to keep going. Don't, you know, they say it's not how many times you fall down, it's a, how many, you know,
that
fall
you
down
back
seven
up.
Times, get down.
Get up eight.
Yeah, exactly.
Exactly.
So the message is a message of, you know, keep going and, you know, don't let the bastards, you know, what's the expression?
I don't know that one, but
is it something like don't let the bastards get you down or
right.
whatever it is, something
yeah.
along those lines. What's something that you wish people would ask you more often? And part B is, what's something you wish people would stop asking you?
I'll answer part B first, and that is, how on earth are you single? I hate that question. Believe me, I don't love being single.
Right.
But, you know.
So is this a public service announcement?
This is a public, yeah, exactly, exactly. I never thought about that. But, you know, it is what it is. I, you know, probably in this past year, I finally come to realization that, like, it would be okay if that was the way it was for the rest of my life, you know, versus holding on to, like, needing to fulfill a relationship or having kids or everything that I always thought I wanted, you know. But what I would wish they'd ask me more is, if you could change one thing, what would that be?
What would your answer be?
My answer would be to have moved away, and I'm not saying any specific location, post-college, to experience a little bit more of what this country or world, depending on the location, had to offer. I kind of stayed homebound, which in hindsight is probably a blessing in disguise because it probably saved my life. Had I gone, you know, any further and moved to LA or moved to Miami, you know, I might not be sitting here right now. But at the same token, I think you learn a lot of life skills being left to your own devices and to figure this thing called life out. So
what I think about is, when you went to college, you lived off campus.
I did.
And things accelerated then.
Exactly.
So maybe what you just said in your last sentence is correct. That wasn't very far away.
Right. 20 minutes.
So, you know, Miami or wherever might have been even more
detrimental.
Yeah, and they would have lost connection with you.
Right.
They would have lost whatever control. I say that with a grain of salt because there wasn't much control.
Right.
But
although,
know,
I thought they were controlling.
Yeah. Yeah. Well, yeah, they probably were as much as they were able to, but, you know, not really doing that. But, you know, it kind of works out the way it works out. You know, we're here right now, however we are. And
exactly.
We move forward. And, you know, who knows, 3 o'clock today when we're at the Westin Hotel and listening to Alan Downs give an amazing speech to the sober community for Pride Week, you may run into somebody. And you know what? A year from now, you'll do another crosstalk. And you'll have your wedding or something like that.
You never
don't know.
Don't know
what's around the corner.
You never know. I'm not planning it, though.
No. No, if there's a wedding, you definitely don't want to do your own planning.
No, I'm not going to do my own planning.
Yeah, that's too much stress. You have to just be there and enjoy it.
Exactly.
Right. Very good. Scott, thank you so much.
Thank you so much. This is really fun.
I really enjoyed it. Your story is, in some ways, really different than everybody else's. And in other ways, it's exactly the same.
Right.
Really depends on whether you're looking at the underlying stuff or the events. But it's been kind of a dramatic shift and turnaround, which is really what recovery is all about.
Absolutely.
It, you know, they say, I think they said to me when I first got into treatment, that it's really simple. All you have to do is change every fucking thing that you're doing.
Absolutely.
And that's kind of what you did.
Totally. And, you know, I think, you know, a couple of things resonate with me, you know, from some of the slogans, like a drug is a drug is a drug. So it didn't matter if it was pot, alcohol, cocaine, crystal meth, like it will lead you down a path.
Right.
And also, as unique as I thought I was growing up, you know, once I was in the rooms of recovery, I realized, you know, I'm not that unique. You know, we're very different, but very similar.
Yeah. I wish I could remember the quote, but my sister told me a quote of gold to my ears, which is something along the line is, you know, don't stress so much. You're not so special or something,
right.
Something
exactly.
Like that. But, you know, we all are kind of wired the same way. We go in different directions. We do different things. We go to different places. But underlying all of it is, you know, we have to learn how to stand up on our own 2 feet, take care of ourselves, and live each day in such a way that we don't try to control every damn thing
mm-hmm.
that's around us and accept the things we can't change.
Yep.
And do the best we can.
Good old serenity prayer.
Exactly.
Yeah. Yep.
That's
absolutely.
Right thing. Let's hug it out.
Absolutely.